Welcome to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast, where top football coaches from around the country share their stories, philosophies, concepts, and strategies to help you get better on and off the field. Now, here's your host, Keith Grabowski.
Coach Hand, welcome to the Coach and Coordinator Podcast.
Well, thank you. Hope I can be of help today.
Coach, I know you've been retired now, but you're still coaching. Tell our listeners a little bit about what you're doing right now.
Well, I stopped coaching about a year and a half ago. And right now I'm coaching boxing down in Mexico. And the reason I stopped coaching football was because after 42 years of teaching English, I kind of got, you know, I had done my duty. And I continued to coach, but I'd be going to a different city or something, and we'd have to try to find a place that we could rent for like 4 months. And then, you know, to get back home, and it just got to be too big of a hassle. So I just said, you know, this is going to be too much. So I decided to hang it up, and I was lucky because they were opening up a gym down in Mexico, and I asked the guy, would you like somebody to volunteer to teach him to box? And he said, sure. And it's been a great trip for our whole family.
Coach, tell us a little bit about your background in boxing.
I was real fortunate. I went to a school in upstate New York that had boxing as a sport. And so I boxed there 2 years. And I didn't play football my first 2 years of high school. And then later on, we moved out in more into the country. And that's when I started playing football. But I had boxed 2 years in high school. And then when I was in college, we had one of the guys on the football team that was a boxer. And so we went to the Golden Gloves. And I saw, you know, the gloves. And I had this thing in my mind that I could beat those guys, and everybody kind of laughed. They said, sure. So the next year I went into the Golden Gloves, and I did, and I won. And I continued to box, you know, through college.
Well, Coach, tell us how you got into the, you know, went from boxing and got into the track of becoming a football coach.
It was kind of a real weird deal because I had about a semester and a half of college left. It was during the summer. And, I was really at that time thinking about becoming a professional boxer because I wasn't, you know, 5'10", 168 pounds. That's kind of small for a college linebacker. So, you know, I was playing college football, but I wasn't real good at it. But I was pretty good as a boxer. And it was during the summer, and one of my friends called me and he says, hey, there's this Jesuit school down the street here that needs a football coach. And I said, well, that's good, you know, but I don't have a degree or anything. And he said, well, go down and talk to him. And I did, and they hired me. And, you know, I found out very quickly that a football coach is very time-consuming. I didn't have time to train as a boxer anymore, and I fell in love with it, and that's how it all started.
Coach, in those early years as a coach, what were some of the things that impacted you and stayed with you as you developed and moved through your career?
You know, it was a baptism of fire because I was hired as the head JV coach because I had played college football. And I knew a little bit about playing linebacker, but I had no idea what a quarterback did or a DB did or a defensive lineman did or anything. So right away, I started reading books, and I think in the first 2 years, I had read every book that they had written on the subject of coaching football. I learned a great deal about schemes, but I knew very little about fundamentals. How does a DB actually cover a wide receiver? How does an offensive lineman actually block? And at that time, there weren't a lot of books written on technique. So I was a schemer for a long time. It wasn't until actually the third year when I was coaching at a school, Aquinas, in upstate New York, where I hooked up with a real good football coach, Bob Rosmarino, and I learned a lot about technique. I became much better as a football coach. However, right after that, I finally went back and finished my degree, and when I came back, I finished during the summer a lot quicker than I thought I was going to finish. One of my high school coaches got a head college job, and I called him because I was working at the gas station at the time, and I called him, and he hired me as the defense coordinator. 2 or 3 weeks before the first game, he became very ill, and he couldn't coach, and there was only three of us on the staff. And the other coach, he was getting married, and he was on his honeymoon. So I was alone with this college football team at 27 years old. It ended up pretty well. We ended up only losing one game, and that was to Tom Coughlin. He was at Rochester Institute of Technology, and I was at St. John Fisher College. So through the years, I've developed more as far as the technique. I mean, that's what the game is about. It's about teaching technique, not schemes. But schemes can be important.
Well, Coach, you've done quite a bit of writing over the years and written a number of books. Obviously, that skill must come from being an English teacher. How did you get into the, you know, from reading every book you could find on to almost writing on every subject, because you've written quite a wide variety of subjects as well?
Right, and it was really just an attempt to try to impress somebody. I was kind of smart about football and try to get a better job. That's what it was all about. But, you know, as the years have gone on, I think the writing has become quite a bit better, and I think that, you know, that they really can be helpful to young coaches.
Coach, I'm sure in your writing you've thought quite a bit about what is your coaching philosophy, and so whether it's football or boxing, those things apply. So what do you identify as your coaching philosophy?
The main thing is my coaching philosophy is, it doesn't matter whether it's offense, whether it's defense, whatever, is we're going to dare to be different. I learned that from a great coach, Al Baldick. And if you've ever read Malcolm Gladwell's book, David and Goliath, he talks about how, you know, Goliath was defeated by David, a much, you know, inferior opponent, because he fought differently. And that's what Geronimo did. He fought a great deal differently than the United States Cavalry. And he surrendered in 1886. When he surrendered, he had 16 warriors, he had 14 women and 4 children. And at that time, it cost the United States government over $1 million to get him to surrender. It took 5,000 United States soldiers, 1,000 Mexican soldiers, 100 Apache scouts, and 100 militia. And he fought so much differently than the cavalry did, and that's why he was so successful. And, you know, anytime a giant's been defeated, it's because they fought differently. So everything that I've done in football has been different than the status quo. And that's my philosophy. And the other thing is technique. Now, technique is extremely important. And, I mean, that's what the game's never going to change. It's still about blocking and tackling and getting off blocks and doing the basic fundamentals. And that's what you got to teach. But the schemes can help you. And that's what I'm always looking for, are little teeny, what I call equalizers, to help our players defeat bigger, stronger, faster players. And there's a lot of equalizers that can be used to defeat, to be successful in this.
Coach, I know you really believe in that stuff, because you even developed a clinic talk, which became a video, with Coach's Choice, Defending the Pistol, What Would Geronimo Do? And you talk about 7 strategies that enabled him to win, and you apply it to defending the pistol. Can you give us an overview of that philosophy and how it applies to something like that, defending the pistol offense?
Well, Geronimo, first of all, you know, he did guerrilla warfare, which was altogether different than what the cavalry did, okay? So what the defense that I picked, the defense that I love, is the double eagle, double flex. And there's probably, I don't think there's a dozen guys in the country running that. It's kind of an old defense that started with Rick Ellerson when he brought it, and they had that Desert Swarm defense down in Arizona. Mm-hmm. He brought it from Canada. At that time, it was a 12-man defense, reduced it down to an 11-man defense, and they were very successful in Arizona. And then I was up at the University of UTEP. They were playing school that Ellison was a coach in. It was somewhere in California. It was a small school. It was a Division II school. And UTEP was far superior in athletic ability. I mean, the size and speed and everything that UTEP had was far superior. In fact, sports writers were kidding him, and they said, you know, what do you think of chances of the game? He says, well, I think we'd be a lot better if we were having a spelling bee at the football game today. But I saw him with that defense, because he had taken it from a single flex to a double flex and just caused all sort of chaos with the UTEP. And just, I forgot what the score was, but he beat them very easily. And it just opened up my mind to a lot of different ideas as far as what I could do with the defense. So what I did in that video was to show how you use the double flex to confuse bigger, stronger, faster players. And so as part of Geronimo's philosophy, you know, there were other things. for example, we with the nomenclature, language, he had a unique language. Of course, he spoke Apache. But I tried to simplify so many different things because at the time when we first started using that, people were going no huddle and stuff, and supposedly it was going to be a problem. But we figured out how to reduce verbiage in the huddle so that, you know, very simple words, we could combine very simple syllables to make words that would convey what we needed to do very quickly. And, the no huddle, hurry up offense, that never became a problem with us because we were able to communicate things so quickly with this new language that we created, you know, understanding the terrain. He understood the terrain. The other thing is he was so physically tougher than the Calvary were. You know, he was used to living off the land, and he was tough. And nowadays, coaches say kids aren't as tough as they used to be, but I think you can make them tougher. We do that. We get into their mind, where I used to when I do it. I do it with boxers now. We get into their mind, you know, and push them past their pain barometer so that, you know, they're going further than they thought they possibly could. And eventually all this becomes just habit. And they realize that pain and discomfort is part of the game. And you can do that in your training. So, you know, that was one of the things that we do is we train them to be tough. And you can train kids to be tough nowadays. They're just as tough as when I played. And I know coaches complain about that a lot. They're not tough anymore. They just want to, you know, do their video games and their telephones and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, you can, we do that. And some of the ways we do that is we push them with their limits. We take plates, you know, weightlifting plates, 45-pound plates or 25-pound plates, depending on their strength. And we do plate punches, you know, and they can't rest it against their body. We may do 100 of them in a row. We take a bar, what I used to do in boxing, you know, a 45-pound bar, and we sprint down the field with that 45-pound bar, and you have to press it every 10 yards, and you go down, you know, the whole 100 yards and come all the way back, you think you're going to die the first few times you do it, but after a while it becomes habitual. And just like pulling the tire, like Bob Lattisler has his guys do up, or had him do up in De La Salle, you know, that it's a whole different ball game. And so we do those kinds of things to put the pressure mentally on them. But a lot of this game is mental. It's like boxing. A lot of it is mental. And so this is what we do to make them tougher. And this is kind of the things that Geronimo did.
Coach, obviously those kinds of things go into building a culture that, you know, you want your team, if we were going to watch a team of yours play, we would start to see that mental toughness. What other things do you do to build that, you know, team chemistry, or what a lot of people refer to now as a culture within your team?
I wish, you know, I've read Lattisler's books, Chasing Perfection. And I wish I would have done some of the things that he had done to build that kind of community. I was deficient in that area. The main thing that I did is when we were working the kids in the weight room in the off season, okay, and even during the season, we always talked about trust. I always asked, can I trust you? Looking them in the eyes. Can I trust you to make this block? When we get down to the red zone, can I trust you to put the ball in? Can I trust you to get off the block and to make the tackle? You know, can I trust you to give everything you got every single play? And I'd look them in the eyes, and they'd look each other in the eyes, you know, and they talk to each other. Can I trust you? You know, I need to trust you. I'm the linebacker. You've got to do your job up front. You know, I'm a defensive secondary guy. You've got to give me a pass rush because I can only guard this thing for about 4 seconds. I can't continue to guard it forever. And you've got to give me a pass rush. Can I trust you to do that? Can I trust you to give me the best thing you got? And that's one of the things, one of the key words we use, can I trust you? It really builds the culture because when a guy is, you know, we're doing some sort of conditioning or tough drill and he's kind of falling behind here, you know, the other guy starts looking at him, I can't trust you right now. And, you know, he picks it up. So I think that's an important thing. But I think what Lattisler did was a great thing. But one of the advantages he had was, you know, it was a Catholic school. Most kids were Catholic, and they, you know, connected into the spiritual. And I think you got to connect into the spiritual. I'm not talking religion now. I'm talking about the higher purpose of this game, which is to make kids better people, to make them, you know, so that they know that they can go through hardship, and they can endure hardship and they can be successful in whatever they decide they want to do. They're going to be good fathers. They're going to be good husbands. They're going to treat their women properly. And, you know, this is what this game is about. You know, we've got to tap into the spiritual. And that was one of the things with Geronimo. He was a medicine man. But again, I envy what Bob Lattiser was able to do up at De La Salle, because he was so much better than probably the rest of us.
Coach, it's already come through that obviously you're a teacher and that language is important to you as well, and how you work your terminology. Culture, when we think about culture, we always think about it as the whole team, but it starts with a culture among amongst the coaches. What's the type of culture that you need to build amongst your coaching staff in order to best teach your players?
The main thing that I emphasize with the young coaches is focus. Like, I'm going to go into the gym today at 4:30. And when I walk through that door, I have to remind myself that my main purpose here on the planet is to make these kids better boxers, to improve their fundamentals. And that's what I always did emphasize with younger coaches. You've got to focus on technique. You've got to focus on their first step. You've got to focus on every step they make. You've got to focus on the body as far as their leverage and so forth. If they're making a block or getting off a block, you got to focus on them. And because this is a very difficult thing for coaches to do, especially young coaches, because they walk out there and they think, you know, a lot of them think, you know, we're going to make them tough, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And they're not focusing in on performance. In other words, I would tell young coaches, you know, if I correct your player, that's kind of an insult to you, because that's your job. It was your job to realize he made a false step. Or it's your job to realize that he wasn't protecting the football if he was carrying it. That's your job. You've got to focus in on that. You've got to forget, you know, what happened last night, you know, with the argument with your wife or whatever might have happened. But you've got to focus in on helping these kids learn to become better football players. Focus on their technique. So when we, whenever we were running a drill or something, you know, that was their job. And I worked for a head coach down in Texas, and he used to bring a cell phone out in practice. And I told him one day, I said, you know, if you were my assistant, I'd fire you for that. You don't bring a cell phone out in a football field. You know, your job is to focus on this football team. That's why that's your purpose on the planet right now, is to make these kids a better football team, because they're putting their faith in you. They're working their hearts out for you. And, you know, you shouldn't be picking up the phone to find out, you know, what you're going to have for dinner or something like that. I can understand it if the wife is pregnant, you know, and she's in the ninth month, or your mother's sick and dying or something. But, you know, I've seen coaches on staffs, and they've got cell phones out there. I'm like, I can't believe this. This is unreal. But that was one of the things, the focus. The other thing is, I'll say it straight up, I don't like huddle. And because we've got a system that's a lot better than huddle. And we are much more efficient, so that when we come together as a group, okay, we took care of business so that they could go home and be with their families. We weren't there all through the night, okay, trying to figure this out, trying to figure that out. We figured those things out in the off season. If you have an offense, I think, you know, and you've got a play that you hang your head on. And right. If they stop that play, you got an answer for it. And you know what you're going to do next, because you know exactly what they've got to do to stop that play. Those are the things, you know, if you have a complete offense, a real offense, you know, you don't have to sit and try to figure out what you're going to do each week. You know what you're going to do because you run an offense, you know, and you practice it and you're good at it. So I wanted them to go home. I wanted them to be with their families. So I didn't keep them in the office for long periods of time, you know, I've seen guys, you know, basically doing nothing, but they had this concept that if they stayed there till 9 o'clock at night, they were going to win football games. And that's not true. They're more than football coaches, the guys you're coaching with. You know, they're your associates and their family people, and they've got children. And I've seen so many coaches that divorce courts and end up with kids who do a lot of problems because they're not home, they're not fathers. They're fathers to the staff, maybe, because, you know, you only got the players for a short time, but then the rest of the time you're you're kind of hanging around the office, sometimes doing nothing. And I've been involved in some of that when I took assistant jobs in Texas. End up sitting around with their feet on the desk watching their college team play rather than getting their work done, getting out and going. I read something in the American Football Coaches Association written by the Navy coach, and he talked about that. He talked about, you know, we come in there, we don't sit around and BS. We get our business taken care of, we go home.
I think that's an important thing, and the distinction you make there between, you know, having a system. I heard a talk on one of our shows by a coach talking about, you know, we don't add a lot of new plays. We want things to work within our system because if something is broken during the game, we know exactly what to do to fix it. Whereas if I'm going from one play to another, I kind of just have a grab bag of plays. I think that's an important distinction for coaches to understand. And I think that's what you mean when you say, well, you know, you don't like huddle because, you know, huddle in some ways does, you know, you could watch film all day long, but it really comes down to not how much film you watch, but how well you know your offense, where what you do to adjust it, and certainly how well your players know it as well. Wouldn't you agree?
Right. And the reason I say about huddle, okay, and the only reason I talk about it, I don't like it. I do like the convenience of it. I did like the convenience of it. I mean, it was great as far as, you know, in the old days we used to have to wait for the bus down at the station, you know, if it was an out-of-town game and, you know, the mail or whatever, and it was really a pain. So huddle makes it very convenient. But what I don't like about huddle is all the data that you receive is in words, and I don't like that. And sometimes there's too much. You know, you get paralysis with analysis. Mm-hmm. What I like to see, okay, and all my scouting reports are in pictures because pictures, it's a universal language. And I know that, you know, like, for example, when I was at a couple of high-profile programs in California, I would lose an offensive-defensive coordinator almost every year because they would get a better job. I mean, they would come in, they'd do a good job. We were, you know, we were ranked very high all the time and, you know, winning. And so people would call and say, do you have somebody who can rig a shoe? You know, and you always want to help coaches advance. So I'd lose them. So if you have this, you know, static nomenclature that you have to use, that you have to train them into that, and you have to it's kind of crazy because there's no universal nomenclature in football. So, but a picture, if I draw a running play and I say they ran this 10 times, I don't have to have even a name for it. And that's the thing, everything that I wanted to do, everything that I did do was in pictures. So when we broke down a film, and I know when they first came to us with this huddle and all these other systems that they have, you know, they came to us and they said, they were talking about what a great thing it was, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, okay, bring your best guy and we're going to break down three films and I bet you I'm going to beat you. I'm going to get it done a lot faster, and we're going to analyze this data a lot more proficiently than you are. Of course, they never did that. Because when we did it, let's say, for example, we have a couple guys on the staff breaking down a team's offense, okay? What I will do is I'll draw every play on a piece of paper. The paper will be divided, you know, into fours, okay? And I'll just like the old cards that they used to have. And then when we get done, I'll cut them up. And then I'll separate them into pass and run, so I know the run tendencies, and I'll give all the passes to the secondary coach, and he can draw up all the passes for the players and how many times they ran them, and then I can do the formation tendencies, and then I can do the run tendencies. Okay, what plays they run, and I can show the players a picture of it. Another coach is just going to do down and distance. Another coach is going to research the personnel and the personnel groupings and how they change, so that we've got, everybody has a job. Nobody sits there and just watches film. Everybody's got a specific job. Now, when they go home or, you know, under free period during the school hour, you know, they can look at techniques of their opponents and so forth. And we do look at the techniques as we're going along, but we've got all that data analyzed. So we can break down three films on offense. We could start at 9 o'clock and we could be done at 1 o'clock and have the scouting report ready at 1:30. And you can't do that without all. Everything is in picture. So nobody's confused. There's none of this words, you know, what do we call this? What do we call that? And how do you keep track of all these, you know, I mean, guys got four wives. How do you name all these different patterns? Because they got so many different variations. You just can't do it.
Right.
So that's my problem. That was one of the things I was going to do when I retired. And I never got with a computer nerd who could help me do this so that we could put these things in pictures. If you look at the NFL scouting reports, a lot of them are photographs, actually.
Right.
You know? And, you know, a lot of pictures, a lot more pictures than words. Because, you know, a guy comes from another team and the nomenclature is all different. And that's the only thing I got about it. Other than that, the huddle's a great thing.
Sure.
But I do want scouting reports and pictures. So do the players.
Well, and I think the important part, too, is the efficiency. However you do it, you have to be efficient. You have to get out of the office, and just that balance you need within your life. You have to have that balance both for yourself and for your coaching staff, that they're able to be family men as well. We talk about it with our players all the time, but I don't know if we're setting the best example when we're there till all hours of the night, you know, in the office away from our family.
Right. And sometimes it's necessary, and sometimes it's not. Now, like, for example, when we would do a scouting report, you know, we'd be done on Saturday, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew what our defense scheme was. We knew what our adjustments were. And, you know, so Sunday I would spend the day out in the desert. You know, I'd go out there and run and then do my prayers out there and, you know, all the things that I do in the desert and walk. And I'd spend about 8 hours out in the desert, you know, thinking about these things and rehashing it and making sure that we were sound on it. And most time there was no, you know, there were very little changes. But I just wanted to be sure, you know, in my own mind as defense coordinator in Texas at that time, that I had, you know, crossed all the T's and dotted all the I's and done everything, and we were totally prepared.
Coach, let's go back to the beginning again for you and think about a mistake that you made as a young coach, and what did you learn from it?
You know, if you start reading every book written on the subject of football, you learn a lot of schemes.
Mm-hmm.
The book you're reading now is so much better than the book you read before, and that book was so much better than the book. So you start jumping around with schemes, and that was a big thing that I did with that was wrong. Okay, was I jumped around a little bit until actually it was my third year of coaching when I went with Aquinas with Bob Ross Marino, and he taught me the I formation, and then you know, so that was the main thing that I was doing that was wrong. I think at times that I, you know, I got caught up in the status quo. I got caught up in, instead of actually using my own intelligence to analyze things and actually think about things, think about why we do things, you know, and that was so important. I think the epiphany came for me when I was an assistant at Long Beach City College, because we played Taft College. And Taft was, I mean, Al Baldick was one of the most extraordinary coaches and people that I've ever met. And his offense, I had never seen an offense that instilled so much fear in players and in the coaching staff as what he was doing offensively. It was just, I mean, they were terrified of what he was doing. After I left there, I was kind of fumbling around when I got that job at Servite High School. I was kind of fumbling around, and I said, "Hey, I'm going to get in that Taft offense." And I didn't even know a whole lot about it at that time. But we were doing real well. We were undefeated running this thing, what I knew about it. And I went up to Al, okay, after he had finished a game. I caught him in the tunnel, and I says, "Coach, I'm trying to run your stuff here, and I'm kind of struggling a little bit, and nobody has put up this one defense. When they put up this defense, I don't know what I'm going to do." And he says, "Oh, I don't let him run that defense." What? I don't let him run that defense. And then he explained to me how he prevented them from running that defense. And that just opened up. I've talked to so many coaches. I've spent so much money on phone calls and so forth, talking to these coaches. And I never heard anybody say that. "I don't let him do that." He was right. He didn't let us do it. I remember the things that, you know, I remember the games that we played against Taft, and he dictated what we did on defense. We didn't dictate anything. So it just opened up my mind to so many different. I remember there was in the American Football Coach's Manual that year, there was one of the, I forgot who it was, but he had written an article about how you pass protect against the Bear 46. And I mean, it was so complicated. It was just unreal. Al just wouldn't let you run the 46.
Right.
It wasn't one of your options. That was your base. That you had to get out of it. That was one of the, I mean, that's when I started learning football, I think. When I started running his office, which is a full house tee, which is, you know, most guys nowadays go, you know, that's out of a cave. You know, but you know, when you think about it, if you got a full house tee there, you've got access to every running game that's ever been invented in the game of football. You have access to every technique. You can double bind them, you can double cross them, you can do whatever you want with that backfield. You got two wide receivers, and they're going to load the box with at least eight. You know, if they don't load it with eight, I mean, you got nine against seven. So you got one-on-one coverage out there. Now, in the pass situation, that's not true. But in a normal situation, you got one-on-one coverage. You and I have both gone to clinics and listened to some guy talk about all these fancy maneuvers he's going to do to get his best receiver one-on-one. And we have that with full house, too. We have that all the time with two wide receivers. I mean, that's all the time. That's one of the things that that really helped me a lot in football was because the first, what was it, 20-some years, I was an I-formation coach, and then after that, you know, I was a full house D coach, except with the exception when I went to Texas and was a defensive coordinator.
And you wrote a book on that as well, the Modern T.
Right, and I helped Al. I helped Al with his book, and that's a book I would highly recommend. Al Baldock's. I've helped a lot of coaches write books because you know I'm a good writer. I write well, and I know how to put it in manuscript form that the publishers want. So I know how to do those things. So a lot of coaches that were struggling with that, you know, I'd spend a lot of conversation. They'd send me their playbook, and we'd have phone calls and stuff. But I must have spent hundreds of hours with Al Baldock on the telephone, and I helped him with his book. And every time I talked with that man, I learned new things. And, you know, I'd been coaching probably 38 years at that time. And every time that, you know, I'd learned something new, that man knew so much. And one thing he told me, and this is, you know, if you study, and Bear Bryant always told us, study football always and always, you know, mm-hmm. always. Always. And that's what I've always tried to do. But Al always tell me, you know, if you study football your entire life, you spend your whole life in it, you probably learn 15% of the game. That's about all you're going to learn because there's so much to learn.
Yeah.
This game has been in existence for 130 years now. That's when, you know, Rutgers played Princeton in that first college football game before the pros even started playing the game. And it's been in 130 years and you know, young guys don't realize we're all products of the past. And I think that what they're doing now with the spread offense, I mean, Dutch Meyer was running that stuff back in the 30s, you know, less than 50 years after the first football game was ever played. And there's really nothing new as far as schemes. It's just been renamed, retweaked, the whole deal. But football is football, you know, and it's blocking and tackling, and your schemes are going to help your guys defeat bigger, stronger players, and that's what they're all about.
Coach, what's the best advice you've received in your career?
Probably was from Al, okay? Dare to be different, okay? And he always told us, okay, is that your offense has got to be like a good toolbox. It's got to have a tool in there that's going to help you, whatever your situation is. So that's what you got to have. That's probably the best thing. You know, dare to be different was the one thing. Al was a whole lot different. For example, he didn't believe in tackling practice. He played at USC, and he's telling me that, you know, the first day of practice, they were doing tackling drills, and I think they lost three players that day, and I think two of them were quarterbacks, he said. It's in his book. I forgot exactly the exact numbers. But, you know, all this banging, banging, banging. One of the great things that I had was when I was in Southern California, USC was just up the street from us. So I went to every single USC practice, spring practice, that they had for like 5 years in a row. John Robinson was great. I mean, he would let us basically almost get in the huddle with the players. I mean, it wasn't one of those things where you're standing on the sideline watching. You could go to the drills. You could get, you know, when they were running plays, all the coaches could stand right behind the huddle, hear everything that was being said, and watch and all the techniques. You could go in the film room. You could watch film. You could anything you wanted. You want to sit down and talk to the coaches? Great. No problem. He was so accommodating to high school football coaches, and I appreciated that so much, is to be able to do that. You know, it wasn't actually a verbal thing, but it was, you know, it was advice from just watching, and it was so important to me in my career. And one of the things that you know, I would say to young coaches is stay healthy. Keep yourself in shape, because I'm 72 years old now. You know, that was one of the things that I always said when I went into coaching. I wasn't going to allow myself to get out of shape and be a mess so that when I retired, I couldn't enjoy life. And today at 72, I still can do almost everything I could do when I started coaching at 23. And I still go down and coach the boxes, and I catch probably almost 1,000 punches on Tuesday and Thursday, you know, with those boxers and moving around the ring and doing those things. Keep healthy, because I see so many coaches that don't stay healthy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they retire, they end up with open heart surgery. They're burned out, and it's not necessary. I always told coaches that when I was, you know, if I was going to apply for a job, if I can't get a good night's sleep and I can't spend, I can't run at least 5 miles every day, then I'm not taking the job. I've got to be able to stay healthy. I got to be able to get some sleep to stay healthy. And I'm going to make sure I eat properly. That's not advice I received. That was just, you know, kind of my own philosophy,
right,
about things. You know, because I see so many people nowadays, older people, retired, and they're just, you know, they sit there in front of the television and drool and wait to die, you know. And it's not the way to live.
No. Coach, obviously you're a deep thinker. You think about a lot of things. So I'm wondering what concerns you have for the future of our game. It certainly has come under attack in a number of ways, and maybe what ideas do you have that help solve some of those concerns?
Doc Peterson, he's got, you know, I wrote about that concussion issue. It was the introduction to one of the books. He hasn't published it yet, but I've thought a lot about that. And one of the things, and I know they're doing, you know, that video that the Seahawks put out is helping a lot with tackling. And I know one of the Ivy League schools, I forgot which one, put out some videos on how to teach football without a lot of contact. I'd been doing that for years. All the years that I was a head coach, we never ran a football play live, ever. We ran it against dummy. Okay? That was one thing. The other thing is, when I went to USC and they had all those great tailbacks, I never saw one of them ever get tackled during practice. That was a no-no. You could bump off on them, but you couldn't tackle them because, you know, that'd be risky. I mean, they'd make them run through a chute where they have to run through, and, you know, they had two dummies smashing them. They'd have to bust through that. They'd have guys hitting their legs with the hand shields and trying to strip the ball and all that kind of stuff. But it wasn't this live kind of stuff that when I went to Texas, I was amazed. You know, they believed that they had to sit there and just, you know, pound each other every single day. And I had never done that. His football, it taught me so many things. It taught me how to be a good human being. It taught me, you know, how to cooperate, how to sacrifice for other people. It taught me that, you know, my success was dependent on everybody else's success. If I was a linebacker, you know, my success was so much dependent upon, you know, the secondary was so much dependent on the defensive line. You know, the offense is dependent on the defense and vice versa. And, you know, and it taught me that we're all connected. That's one of the things we don't understand in our society anymore, that we're all connected. And this is one of the games that teaches that. Like I say, I learned more on a football field than I learned in church, than I learned in school, than I learned at home, than I learned any other place. That was my education on a football field. We've got to keep this game. It's a great, great game, you know. And I'd love to coach it again if, you know, if it didn't mean, you know, having to teach English. And, you know, I was never interested in college ball too much because I don't get, you know, I don't get on airplanes.
Right.
And that's one of the requisites. You know, you got to get on airplanes, and there's a lot of other things. You know, you got to, like, I don't own a telephone. This telephone, I was real worried about your call because my wife went shopping, and I don't know how to access a text, and I don't know, you know. Sometimes I press the wrong button, and the call doesn't come through. I understand computers because I have to do that for writing, but, you know, when you get older, you got choices. You don't have to do some things that you had to do before.
Right.
But you're right. This game is, we got to keep this game. This game is so important. I love this game.
Coach, we have a two-minute drill here. Just some quick question and answers to finish things up. So the first one's this. What's the toughest defense to face schematically?
And all the, schematically, they're all the same. You know, the toughest for me to face is one with good personnel. You know, if, for example, with our offense with a full house key there, if you can run a seven-man front, you, and beat us, you get some good personnel. You're good. You know, if you run an eight-man front, we can get you out of that. We can get you in a six-man front real easy. So it's not a problem. So I don't think schematically it really matters that much. I think what really matters is the personnel.
Coach, what's your favorite goal line play?
Getting the ball in the hands of our best football player, the kid that's going to put it in there. I mean, that's our best play, whether it's a run or whether it's a pass. It doesn't matter. Get the hands and the ball of your winner.
My high school football coach always used to tell us, give me players, not plays.
Yeah. My wife even always says, now, you know, I got her trained. She says, if you can't score from one, you don't deserve to win. If you can't make a first down, you got 1 yard to go, you don't deserve to win. She says that all the time.
Coach, what's your preference, turf or grass?
Doesn't matter to as far as game time, as far as practice, it does if you're practicing on turf, especially in this area where we live here down in the desert, because, you know, it brings the temperature up 15 degrees. So,
right.
if it's 95 out, you know, you're practicing a lot of heat.
Day game or night game?
Oh, I like day games because if we play on Saturday, then I get the scout in person on Friday.
What's your favorite quote?
My favorite quote? Dare to be different.
Should the kickoff be eliminated from the game?
Yes.
I'm going to pick your brain on that a little bit. Why do you think so?
The injury factor. The injury factor is just, you know, I worry about, I always, you know, that's one of the things when they're kicking off, I'm praying that nobody gets hurt on this thing. You know, I lost one player. I've only lost in my whole career, 47 years, well, as a head coach. You know, I lost, I think, three players was all to injuries. In other words, for the season. And one of them was on the kickoff. And he was a key player, and it was a big thing. I'm not a big fan of the kickoff, and I don't know the research as far as the number of injuries, but I think when you got a running head start of 30, 40 yards with another guy, you're going to hit him. You know, it's a matter of physics here. You're going to hit him a lot harder than if they're in a closer proximity.
Definitely.
So basically, when I was coaching, we eliminated the kickoff. We did little pooch kicks, and we're going to give it to you on the 30-yard line, and that's where you're going to start. We're fine with that.
Coach, what's a book you would recommend to our listeners?
As far as a football book, Chasing Perfection. I mean, it's Bob Lettiser. And, you know, when God writes a book, you say, thank you, yes, sir. And, you know, you don't argue with it. The other book would be Malcolm Gladwell's book, David and Goliath.
Coach, how many teams should be in the FBS playoffs?
No opinion. I don't know. I let the smarter guys figure that one out.
I don't know if anybody's going to figure that one out. It seems like something we could argue about forever.
Right.
Coach, good job on the two-minute drill there. Here's the final question for you. What's the one thing you would point to as giving your teams over the years the winning edge?
The winning edge? Okay. Basically, we taught them to be tough. And we taught them to love one another and trust one another. Taught them that, for example, you know, we love the only guy that's ever been a captain on one of my football teams has been an offensive lineman. Because we've got to love those guys because they're the unsung heroes. And we treat those guys royally. And everybody on the team does, running backs, everybody. It's because they never hear the name announced over the loudspeaker. They never, you know, they just get in the trenches. They bleed, they hurt, they persist, they fight. And there's no glory to it. And those are the real guys. And, you know, so that's got to for sure be a factor. And the other thing is we always gave equalizers to our players so that they were able to compete against bigger, stronger, faster players.
Well, Coach, I really appreciate the time you spent with us here today and some interesting conversation I know our listeners are going to enjoy. I would love to have you back on the show another time to talk about more things in this game because, like you said, you know, you could spend your whole life learning it. You're only going to touch on 15% of it. So I think you and I can find some more things to talk about in the future. But thanks again. And last thing is, how can our listeners connect with you?
The best way is to write me a letter, okay? And I will give you my address, okay? P.O. Box 761, Columbus, New Mexico, 88029. And I have coaches, sometimes players too, that come here to train. And I have coaches that come here, and anybody want to talk ball, you know? I've got a lot of room here. I built these little small buildings, and I'm in one of them right now. And, you know, we always got a bed for anybody and, you know, food on the table and no problem. They want to come and spend a week here. And I've had a couple guys do that. And but if they write me a letter, because I got an email, I think I got, I don't know how many thousand now, unopened emails. And, you know, so. And the telephone, I'm not real good on it. Like I say, I don't own one. My wife has it. She can't tell us who called stuff. So, but if they write, for sure, you know, and if they ever want to stop by and stay here for a while, they can stay and we'll talk football as long as you want. And like I say, last year we had a player come and train here for a month.
Well, Coach, certainly appreciate you making that offer to the listeners, and I appreciate the time you took with us today.
Thank you. I appreciate you giving us the time. I hope it helped.
Thanks for listening to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast. For more resources, visit the Coach Performance Center at usafootball.com.